listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Susan McCarty, whose story collection Anatomies was published in June by aforementioned productions. Susan McCarty is an assistant professor at Salisbury University on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Her stories and essays have appeared in Conjunctions, West Branch, Indiana Review, Barrel House, Utney Reader, Iowa Review, Everyday Genius, Tarpaulin Sky, and other tasty places, as she says in her bio. Susan has an MFA in fiction from the Vermont College of Fine Arts and a creative writing PhD from the University of Utah. In her past life, she worked in mass market and genre publishing at Penguin and Avalon Books. Now she divides her time between Maryland and Michigan. She occasionally lives with the writer Matt Kirkpatrick and some dog companions. I do believe Matt is her husband. When I spoke with Susan McCarty in August, I asked her to begin by reading her story, The Last Night They Spent Together Before the Separation.
The Last Night They Spent Together Before the Separation. They put the children to bed, all eight of them. They put the camera crew members to bed, all eight of them, but most of the crew stayed up, listening through the thin suburban floors, clutching their fists at each other for all that was not being recorded. In the kitchen, she said to him, "You may not agree, but the children really are the most important thing. We have to think of them in all this." He said to her, "I know." And then he said, "You don't have to be such a bitch about it." She said, "Is that the way you talk to the mother of your children?" And he said, "Stop thinking of the children. Just for a minute, can't you think of us?" She did not storm away into another room because she could feel the camera crew listening. And even though they were each tucked into beds in the bunking area behind the false wall in the basement and their cameras were not on, she felt beholden to them like a child to its teachers. Instead of storming away, she took a bag of apples provided by Dole and began to slice them for the children's lunches. Thus, she was in a position to dramatically thrust the knife into the air when he made his next remark, which he delivered as if it were scripted, though that was not strictly allowed. "I think I'm in love with someone else." There was a satisfying thunk as the knife became a heavier weight in her hand and torpedoed as if by destiny into the heavy wood cutting board in front of her. She thought to herself, "Cut." She may have actually said, "Cut." And then an uncertain silence fell between them because what more was there to do or say? He had backed up against the refrigerator when the knife came down, as if he'd been commanded to wince, though he knew exactly where that knife would go and that it would stay there. This was not court TV. He stood in a small avalanche of happy drawings of houses and stick mommies and daddies and finger-painted abstractions that he was almost certain had not been made by his own children, but by the children of his producers and editors, and, it was rumored, perhaps by the extremely gifted 2-year-old daughter of one of the network executives, a toddler with a prodigious understanding of light and color and space, drawings that had come down when he had backed himself without fear against the refrigerator door while her knife came to rest in the place that it had to. So she moved to him, and now he did wince because it was not something he understood. Her mouth was doing that slight twitching thing it did, which could mean she was annoyed or about to laugh, or possibly that she was having an allergic reaction to the heavy foundation she wore so her skin would appear skin-colored on television. He wasn't sure anymore. He wasn't sure he had ever been sure. He might watch old episodes in his new bachelor pad to see if there was something recognizable about the way her mouth moved in the first season. Or perhaps it was a tick she had picked up for the cameras. He would go back and watch all the seasons to see what fragments of his wife revealed themselves and build a montage of her, something that would finally make sense. So she moved to him and put her mouth to his neck, then his jaw just below the left earlobe, then the earlobe. The camera crew, highly trained in their field, heard the small sound of something strange and intimate taking place and pounded the carpeted floor of their chamber with their angry hands. She kissed his chin. She took one of his hands, which was curled into a half-hearted fist, and flattened it out between her two hands. She kissed his hand. He could not remember if she was tender. she was edited to sometimes be tender, but was she? She was murmuring something as she kissed him, but she couldn't understand what she was saying until he lowered his head to where her lips met his chest. Is it you? She was asking. Is it you? What's more, he realized, as his head came down to touch her head, she was not quietly kissing him, but smelling him. It was her nose, not her mouth, which left his skin damp and goosebumped where she touched him with it. She smelled his forearm below the elbow crook. She smelled his side just above his hip, where his jeans made a hard ridge beneath his t-shirt. He still smelled the same, which meant that this could not be happening. For a moment, she thought of the knife again. For a moment, she thought of another life entirely. In the dark, the camera crew crept into a pile on the hard, hooked gray carpet. The places where they squeezed each other for reassurance were soft and sometimes moist. For a moment, he looked at the knife stuck deep in the cutting block. For a moment, he could not imagine any part of the life that had come before this. From the hall came a shrill noise, like the cry of an animal before it is eaten by a bigger animal. They both stood up straight. They both thought of the children, though each of them thought of a different child in particular. The camera crew stood barefoot in the dark hallway. They were cold, they said. They couldn't sleep. Their hands were open and red, as if to show the source of their cold and sleeplessness. She put apple slices in their hands. He marched them back downstairs. When he came back up, he said he thought he might watch reruns for just a little while before bed.
Thank you for reading that.
Thank you.
I really enjoy that story. You know, as I was reading that, one question that came to me was, did the knife just happen as you were writing and then become an important object in the story? Or did you think of the knife ahead of time as part of the story?
I love that question because I feel like I'm always trying to pinpoint, when I read stories, I'm always trying to pinpoint like the object or images that sort of set the story off in a certain direction. So
yeah.
That's the question I ask myself when I'm reading stories all the time. So thank you for asking me. Actually, no. So the knife came, that was not something I thought about first. The knife came to me. I thought something dramatic has to happen here, but it can't be too dramatic, right? It's not court TV. So that sort of came as the dramatic thing that would happen and sort of set the rest of the story in motion.
Yeah. And I love this moment where she thinks of another life entirely. And it's so much fun because as the author, you could give her another life entirely, but it may not work for the story.
Right. I'm totally withholding in that way. Yes.
Yeah, that's funny.
Well, so, and I think that when you think about reality TV too, that's always like, this is a life sort of, but then what life is this life that we're seeing covering, you know?
Right. Now, do you watch some reality TV and that's what gave you the idea? Or did you kind of have to go and watch some because you're like, I know this exists, but I don't really spend a lot of time with it. So I have to do some research to see what it's like.
I could take the high road and say the second, but I would totally watch reality TV. I watch it less now that I have less time with my job, but I definitely am fascinated by reality TV, and I've probably been watching it on and off since, you know, that first Real World in Manhattan in the 90s. Because it's such a strange social experiment, and what it's become, there's this huge arc to reality TV where it's become its own genre, you know,
right.
So like reality has a capital R and it's in quotation marks now.
Right, right. And the people that are in the reality shows, they don't, I mean, this rang so true for me. They must not really feel like they have a life that's just life happening, you know. It's like everything's for the camera. It's just so strange.
I can't imagine having any intimate moments in a family setting, you know.
Right.
Like I my sense of a family is, I don't have children, but my sense of having been a child once myself is that you need, for a family to exist and be strong, you need moments of privacy and intimacy, and you need to sort of hunker down together sometimes.
Right.
And it just seems like, especially in the family, reality TV shows, that's just kind of taken away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And which seems brutal to me.
Yeah, it does. And I think also it's kind of hard because the adults at least have enough experience to put on a show for the TV, but children, I think children, I don't know, it just seems like they're so set up in this situation. I don't know.
Yeah. Kind of exploitative, but fascinating too.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about how this collection, Anatomies, got started. Was there a certain point when you recognized the anatomical links between your stories and they became a collection, or did you start with the idea of Anatomies and sort of write toward that?
Yeah, well, I sort of, something in the middle. So I had some of these stories already written, and the last story, Anamnesis, the epilogue, is, when I wrote that, that was the story that kind of put into perspective the collection or the possibility of a collection, because Anamnesis is a sort of, well, an anamnesis is a medical history,
right?
So it's this narrator's imagine. It's kind of an imagined medical history of greatest fears or things that have happened to me, the author, and there's also this sort of imagined narrator who's narrating her own medical history.
Right.
And I thought that was a really, a medical history is a narrative. It's a story. And the idea for Anamnesis came from the idea that Plato puts forth, that Anamnesis is a concept for him that means that when we're born with knowledge inside of us, all the knowledge we'll ever have. And so teaching or learning is about unlocking that knowledge. And luckily, that's not true, right, necessarily. But it has been pointed out to me that it is sort of true. Like, the study of genetics is, you know, the sense that there's this knowledge inside of our bodies that needs to be unlocked and learn everything there is to learn, right? And you can even go back. Things are going on inside of us genetically that have their antecedent generations before we were even an idea, right? Generations before we were born. So anyway, so this idea of medical history or anamnesis, I liked both of those concepts, that the body is the site of stories, of a medical narrative, and then the body also contains stories or knowledge within it when we're born. So that idea really was crystallizing for me when I thought about starting to pull together a collection. And then I started to write more towards that idea. But I'd already been writing a lot of the sort of body-based stories. Mm-hmm. So
did you have any, like, medical knowledge apart from, you know, do you have any medical background or knowledge that you drew upon?
No. No, not at all. none whatsoever. No, okay. I just think it's an interesting concept. And I think that's the cool thing about being a writer, right, is that we find these concepts that are interesting to us, and then we get to kind of research them and apply them in these weird and cool ways.
I loved that epilogue, Anamnesis. It's so awesome, you know, like, just, and I, just so that listeners can have a sense, it's just a single line after single line over, you know, continuing on for several pages about the diseases or perceived diseases or, like, multiple incorrect self-diagnoses, you know, just like, and all of the, it's so much fun. Worked in food service while suffering from mononucleosis. 3 concussions. consistently underhydrated. I don't know. It was very funny. So I wanted to ask you, Susan, if you've ever thought about what for you constitutes a successful story ending. I think sometimes when we write stories, there's this sense of beginning, middle, and end, but an end is different than, you know, all the threads wrapped up or tied together neatly for different people. So I just wondered, what for you would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one of those, it's kind of ephemeral, so it's sort of hard to define, but my favorite ending of all time is the ending of The Dead by James Joyce, the last paragraph, where he's looking out and seeing the snow falling on Dublin and imagining the snow falling in all these different spots that are important to the story and important to the narrator and his wife. And I think that what I love about that ending is that it kind of zooms out and gives us a greater appreciation of the smallness of these lives, and but how Joyce has made them important anyway. Right? They're small compared to all the other lives and struggles happening in Dublin, but this moment is sort of crystallized in that zooming out. So that's one ending I love. I think Chris Noel from Vermont College, one of my mentors, had this great thing he would say that I pass on to my students, which is that an ending should both be inevitable and surprising. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way of thinking about how to end, right?
Yeah.
So something that has been, the story has been written into the story already, but that's not sort of the expected thing, right?
Yeah.
But that's not to say, I mean, the hard thing about that is when I teach undergraduates creative writing, and I think sometimes they read that as like a twist ending, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, how to make a story surprising at the end is to put a twist ending on it. And that's, I blame movies. I blame TV shows. So that's, it's a fine line, right, between a twist ending that no one could ever have seen coming and doesn't, and sort of invalidates the rest of the story, or a surprising ending that supports the rest of the story and that makes perfect sense, even though it's new to us.
But surprising, I mean, what surprises us at different stages in our lives probably changes too. And so what they think of as a surprise is like somebody jumping out, right?
He was a dream all along, and he was a murderer. Yeah,
it was a ghost.
Right. Well, and I don't mean to patronize or condescend to my undergrads, because they're awesome, and they have lived, many of them have lived experiences that I will never have, and many of them have, you know, George Saunders says that we all have the emotional capacity to, like, the things that are going to happen to us in some form have happened to us by the time we're 19 or 20, so we can kind of extrapolate from the emotional experiences we've already had.
Right.
Mostly all the stuff you need to know to write. Right. So I don't mean to disparage my student writers, but they certainly, it's true that like too many movies and too much TV instills a lot of bad habits, but I feel like it's my job to start to break with them.
Yeah. All right. So speaking about your students, I was wondering how they've reacted to your character in the story Indirect Object, which is about an ACT tutor. Do they ever react defensively to that one?
Well, see, this is the great thing about publishing a book in the summer is you don't know. I don't know. So a couple of my students have very graciously bought and read my book, which I think is so lovely, and have said really nice things about it. So,
yeah.
Like I said, my students are wonderful. I don't know, you know, if any of them have trouble with that story. But again, that's a story that's really, for me, a story that's about sort of the horrors of capitalism on teaching, you know, and also about loneliness. Mm-hmm. So I like to think that what I'm doing now, the job I have now, is sort of the answer to that, or fix for that.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other stories mentions teaching, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting which one and what the context was, but there was this mention of stage fright in teaching, and I was wondering if you've ever gotten stage fright when you first taught, maybe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that teaching is, some people are really engaged and energized by teaching, which is a performance, right? And I have learned how to be energized and engaged. At first, teaching was really draining for me. It felt important, and it felt like I wanted to be doing it, but weirdly, it would be frightening and exhausting, and I mean, maybe not weirdly, it's a performance. So somebody who's sort of more tending on, I tend towards the introvert side of the scale, more towards the extrovert. And so, and so to kind of come out and, you know, give this performance over and over again, was very difficult at first, but I've, you know, have little tricks. And still on the first day of class, I always get nervous. And, okay. and I know a lot of my friends and colleagues who teach say the same thing. Yeah. But it's, you know, like I read the syllabus and we go around and I make them, you know, say something funny about themselves. And so we're all laughing by the time it's really time for me to speak to the students.
You've already made them say something embarrassing before you start.
Exactly. Totally debase them. so by that point, I am on top of the world. Just, yeah. No, I love, and I want to stress that I really love teaching, but it's not something that came naturally to me. And so mm-hmm. it's something I've really had to work on. But I think the plus side of that is that it's something I've thought a lot about, and I feel like the decisions I make as a teacher, they're purposeful, and I try to sort of think through every decision, and mm-hmm. and yeah. So I hope that, you know, it's a good way to approach teaching.
Yeah, and I want to just really quickly one more question about teaching before we get back to this to the book.
Sure.
But you have an MFA and you have a PhD, and I'm wondering if mm-hmm. you knew that you wanted to go into teaching when you got those degrees, or did you get those degrees toward your writing career, or a little of both?
The MFA, definitely, I had no, teaching was not sort of on my radar at that point. I was working as a assistant romance editor in Penguin and then Avalon Books in New York, and I really wanted to stick with that job, and I thought the MFA was for my own writing, but would also give me this kind of better insight into editing as well, which it certainly did.
Yeah.
But then I ended up, and I loved being an editor, but at some point I realized that the thing that I loved most about editing was I realized that I loved going to the conferences. So I go to these conferences on the weekends, and I'd have these meetings with authors, and we'd do small group workshops together, and that's the thing that I really loved. I did not love running P&L sheets, and I did not love going to cover design meetings. And the thing I loved was working with the writers. So that sort of got me, and I was interested in getting more school and just learning more for my own writing and edification too. So that's when the PhD sort of came about. And then, of course, if you're going to get a PhD, you're really... it's a huge time and energy commitment and money commitment as well. And so you're really going with the aim of getting a teaching job afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
So then that's when that crystallized. And that's when I learned, when I started learning how to teach. I feel like that's an ongoing process that will probably never end, but...
Right. Okay. All right. Great. Now I wanted to go back to the book in the story called Fellowship. There's a reference at one point. There's a reference early in the story to mom and dad having called a family meeting. The main character of this story is a young woman who's still living at home, and mom and dad have called a family meeting. And then it's really clear that it's a super important subject, but you delay sharing the details. You delay letting us know what's going on for a little while in that story and what the family meeting was about. And it's sort of implied, but I wonder if you can talk about your impulse in this particular case to kind of delaying that information.
Yeah, thanks for kind of noticing that. It's interesting to think about that delay, because I don't know that I did it. It was a purposeful decision, but it's sort of buried under years and years of revising. But I think, so let me go back. But I think what I remember feeling was like, oh, kids who have lived through a divorce will get what the family meeting was about.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like an exclusion for my, you know, for the people who have been through a family divorce and the sort of ordinary tragedy of that. And I think it was kind of a moment of winking at them, like, you know what I mean when I say mm-hmm. a family meeting. And then besides that, then it was a way to sort of delay tension and build tension around what has happened and sort of keep the reader invested.
Yeah, well, I personally went right back to that family meeting in 1973, so
I'll tell you that. Yeah, I'm sorry, but yeah.
No. Okay, so that's good. So building tension also, as far as like the delay of information.
Yeah, absolutely. this is something else my mentor, Christopher Noel, always talked about, was sort of, you know, taking the reader by the hand and taking them through a story and building tension by delaying answering every question.
Yeah.
And I think of a story or a novel is always a mystery. There's always a question or a series of questions that the author poses to the reader, you know, either explicitly or not, and then delays answering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why many of us read,
yeah.
I think.
Okay, great. So the collection is organized in sections, which actually are called dissections in the beginning, with parentheses around the dis. Animalia, histology, bacterium, and then the epilogue that you talked about earlier, anamnesis. And then within each section, there are stories that have their own titles. So I wondered, how much work in the revision process did you and your editors maybe spend, you know, kind of shuffling and organizing and deciding what went where, and like, how literally did you, for your own purposes, you know, use these larger categories of animalia, histology, bacterium? Like, how did that work?
Sure. Those were the brilliant idea of my brilliant editor and publisher, Carissa Halston, at aforementioned Productions.
Okay.
I like to think of, you know, you write a book, you write it, you make it as good as you possibly can, and you bang your head against it for years and years, and then that's like actually only probably been 80% done, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right.
You're like, this is 100% done. It's it. I can't do any more work on it. And then you send it out in the world, and you find a publisher, and that publisher is like, okay, hold my hand, and I'll take you the rest of the way. And at least that's the ideal, right?
Right.
And Carissa really, aforementioned, had a vision for this book, and she probably took it more like 25 or 30% of the rest of the way. She was able to sort of see the way the different stories broke down into different sections,
yeah,
in a way that I was too close to see.
Mm.
At the same time, she kind of gave it this structure that I had been struggling to figure out for years, but had not quite been able to figure out. And when she said, okay, what do you think? What about these different sections, animalia, histology, and bacterium? And what about this order? And I thought, yes, that's it. It was like, you know, it was like a key opening a lock or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so perfect. And so I felt like I was really lucky as a writer to find like my perfect reader in an editor and a publisher. And so working that last, you know, that working on the book and finishing it up with aforementioned with Carissa really was wonderful.
I mean,
she sort of gave the structure that it has and worked with me on edits, and it was all a pretty painless process.
That's great.
Compared to what it certainly could have been.
Yeah.
But
yeah
so that now was a really wonderful experience.
Did she also find the inside illustrations? You have this amazing, first of all, you have an amazing cover, which I am assuming there was a cover designer that found that, but mm-hmm. then inside there are these illustrations, and I looked and it said that they were from, I can't remember how many hundreds of years old they are. They're so awesome.
So this is all, again, Carissa, my editor, Carissa Halston, my editor and publisher at aforementioned, she actually sent me the cover before we had decided to publish the book. She really loved the book, and she just mocked up this cover and sent it to me, and my heart just melted, and I thought, oh my God, that's the cover of my book. We got to do this thing.
Yeah.
And she also came up with their illustrations from an old, out of copyright anatomy textbook. So she paired them, found them and paired them with each story, and I really love them. I didn't expect to have any illustrations in the book, and I think they really add something.
They do.
Ineffable.
I mean, the book would be wonderful on its own, of course, but I did find myself starting to expect the next one. It was like, okay,
right.
New story, new picture.
Right. Yeah, and I like that you can kind of look at the story and look at the picture and try to guess what the story is going to be about. I think
yeah.
she did a really, and some of the pictures are very funny, and she did a great job.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit. Okay, so the blurbs on the back of the book, you have a blurb by Scott Garson that calls the book a marvel of craft and life. And then Matt Bell says your stories are as varied as they are accomplished, moving effortlessly between subjects and voices and forms, which in particular, that was something I was really struck by, just the creative territory that you cover. Your narrative points of view are first person, third person, second person, plural, first person. And then you do lots of different tenses. You're in the present tense or the past tense, you know, very specific to each story, not like you're jumping around, but just wonderful. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about that. I was curious specifically if any point of view is easier or harder for you and how much it varies by story.
Sure. I definitely think it changes, or it has changed in through my writing life. I started out by not being able to write a first-person story at all, and I would sort of fall back into the second person. So which is not to say that's not advice, not something you should do. There are two completely separate points of view for different purposes, but I was sort of subbing in the second-person point of view for the first.
How interesting. Wow.
And I wonder if it's because I was not assertive enough to sort of have an eye out there as a character. But for whatever reason, I avoided first person for forever. And I got really comfortable writing in second person and third person. But then I sort of started to kind of realize in these various ways that I was just taking it out with second person, you know, that second person is doing its own thing and is not just a substitution for first. And so I think the different points of view is really kind of a little bit about an evolution of style for me.
Okay.
But I also really like different points of view, and I feel like, and different formal aspects of stories are interesting to me. So one of the things, like the story Field Reports, which is sort of told in this like clinical, detached, full sentence.
Right, it's a report. So
whatever a field report may be, it's so the narrator is kind of this floating consciousness that you assume is some kind of observer, you know, impartial observer. That I just really, for that story, the idea of for the story and the form both came, sort of emerged for me at once. And I feel like, you know, point of view is a facet of form. And so when I have a story idea, point of view, and the way I want to write the story just sort of comes out somehow, magically.
Follow
it.
And then, do you ever have to play around? Like, okay, I'm gonna set the first person aside and put in, you know, third person and see how that plays. And do you do a lot of that? Or
I do sometimes, and that's, I always make my students. It's an exercise I make them do because sometimes we're writing in the wrong point of view, and what we actually should be writing in is one or the other. And so I do, and I'm trying to think if there's a story here. Where I had a total reversal of point of view. I think there might be, but I can't remember which it was. But yes, I think that's a great exercise, even if you end up not changing the point of view in the final version of a story. Is that it's just a great way to sort of figure out, toggle your voice and figure out if you're where you need to be point of view-wise.
Right. How about tense? Like, do you have any preferences between working in the present tense, the past tense?
I think I love the present tense. I think the point of view, second person point of view, along with present tense, makes the story feel very immediate to me. So I think stories that I write those stories more quickly too. There's this sort of, there's just a rolling along that happens. There's a very fast unfurling that happens when I use present tense.
Yeah.
And I think past tense, I use that for longer stories and stories that seem where there's maybe more backstory that needs to come in and more of a past that weighs heavier, and I want it to be a slower, more reflective story. But again, it kind of is that way, and then kind of it's just this ineffable, like, oh, that just sounds better, you know, magic.
Right, that magic, yeah. Then I want to stick a little bit with field reports. In field reports, you give the characters just identities of X and Y, and you did the same thing in this wonderful story called Passive Aggressive, which I just loved. And then sometimes you name your characters, and then sometimes you don't. Even when you don't use X and Y, sometimes they don't have names. There's one that there's sister and brother. Do you enjoy not naming characters? Sometimes it's hard to put these questions into questions because I don't mean do you enjoy it. I'm just trying to figure out advice for writers.
I think it's a great question. I think that the answer is that I'm really bad at naming characters. So whenever I can avoid doing it, I do. You know, you have these characters that are. Names don't pop into my head like Point of View or Tense does. And so you have these characters that you're building and that are evolving and you're writing out their lives. And then you have to name them like Bill or something. Nothing wrong with the name Bill. My dad's name is Bill. I love Bill, but it just seems so strange. Like it's a way that when I name characters, it sort of automatically makes them strange to me, which maybe isn't necessarily a bad thing now that I'm thinking about it, but I'm writing a novel right now and I've changed the characters' names like 4 times.
I find that so hard, and particularly if you get way into it and then you change the character's name. Like I had a novel where somebody gave me the advice that I had chosen a name that was too unusual and hard to pronounce by reading it on the page, and so I was like, oh, so I changed her name, and then I couldn't get there.
It's like, who is this person? This is not you.
This is not my beautiful character.
Jane.
Okay. I want to talk about the story called Pest. I love the story so much, and it's funny, I was tempted to have you read that one for the show, but it's so unusual, I didn't really want listeners to think this is the style of her writing, although the fact that it exists is fabulous and I love it. But actually, I'm wondering, could you read just a small section and then we can talk about it? Would you mind?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Pest. A scratching and the singing of light through a million filaments, a brilliant stench and the peck of these feet, haunch high, it is not a slink so much as a hump. Here in stump we say, where you come from now, was in stump we say, is when we are in stump that such happens. Woe is why we in stump to begin, some in stump and some out in form, twos or so in stump, but in form all, noses raising fog, we smell each and each and each. So that's the first few sentences of Pest.
Pest. All right, so talk about this. Talk about this.
Sure.
It is just such a beautiful, poetic, strange story, and I was fascinated.
Thank
I read
you.
It like 6 times. So anyway, go ahead.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. There was a call out for stories from a journal called After Coetzee, and referring to J.M. Coetzee, the South African writer, who is also a proponent of animal rights and a very outspoken vegan and sort of very involved with the rights and consciousnesses of animals.
Okay.
And so there's an anthology named after him, and they were looking for works that did not privilege the animal over the human and didn't use the animal as metaphor, but actually engaged with the animal in some way. And so I thought, this is a great assignment, you know. I think I even missed the due date, so I didn't even end up sending it into the anthology. But I thought it was a really interesting question, like, what language is so human, right? Written language is so utterly human.
Right.
How are we to express the animal through it? And so that was sort of what came about. I was just thinking about that, and I was thinking about sort of a colony of animals, maybe mice or maybe rats or maybe squirrels or chipmunks, something small and mammalian. And I sort of was thinking of how would they communicate, and if they had to put it into language, if there was a translation that had to occur. What might that look like? And so, and that's what happened with, that's how Pest came out. And it really came out all at once. And then when it was done, it was done. And I couldn't sort of get back to the voice at all. So it was really just an exercise in, like, it's a little bit of like being possessed, you know, when you have those moments of writing that are, for me, all too rare, where you just are on and something happens and you almost feel like you're not even conscious of what you're doing. And that's kind of what Pest was. And I could never go back and write another one.
Well, it's just so unusual, you know, and I just think it must have been such a rush when you had this written down. I mean, then all of a sudden it exists.
Yeah, it was really fun, and like figuring out sort of like how would a small mammal refer to, you know, express fear, or I don't know, it was really like inhabiting a different consciousness for, you know, for a minute, and it was awesome.
Yeah,
to write it.
And so I would call that sort of experimental, and some of your other stuff, I think you're experimenting with you know, like format in field reports and passive aggressive, and also subject matter in a story called Zombie Apocalypse, which, you know, maybe it's not experimental if it were a science fiction story, but it's really not. It's more literary fiction. So anyway, I have the sense that you enjoy experimenting a bit, and I wondered if you could talk about that did you become more experimental as you became a more experienced writer? Have you always played around with this stuff?
That's a good question. I think really it was, I became more interested in experimental writing as I read more, actually. So as I sort of went back to get my PhD, and first of all, had to sort of go back and for my PhD exams read all of these books that maybe I'd read in college when I wasn't really paying attention, you know, like Moby Dick and Jane Eyre, Don Quixote, all these amazing, amazing works of literature that when I was when I was 20, I was not as interested in them as I should have been.
Right.
And so I went back and I realized, read all these books and they were so fascinating to me, because what became apparent is what Andrew Monson says about the history of literature is that it's the history of experimentation. And I wholeheartedly agree. You know, all of these canonical works that we hold up as, and that maybe some of my students or some, you know, think of as old, boring, you know,
the black and white films.
Right. Yeah. Like, blah, put me to sleep. But they're really interesting and they're fascinating and they do these strange experimental things. And that sort of really got me interested. And then combining those older works with newer contemporary works that I was also reading at the time, like Kathy Acker, Lance Olson, and Melanie Raitone, who are my mentors at Utah, and just my awesome classmates. My husband, Matt Kirkpatrick, is a fantastic experimental writer. And so I sort of was all of a sudden, you know, sort of facing this crisis of, who am I as a writer? Realism isn't real, and all this artifice, and you know, this sort of stodgy idea I had about the history of literature is completely been upended. And so, I wanted to start incorporating more experimenting into my fiction. And I also think it was a point where I knew how to write sort of traditional realist. Although I do think that's a straw man, that there is such a thing.
Right.
But we think there is such a thing, right?
Yeah.
I knew how to write a traditional realist short story, and I wanted to sort of start thinking about other ways to get stories across.
Yeah.
And my husband, who's far more, I think, experimental and avant-garde than I am, says that really he's just trying to write a love story. And I really love that. And I think what I take from that is that, you know, if there's heart and emotion in your story, that the form always matters, but at the same time it doesn't matter at all. That
right.
That just because something is experimental doesn't mean it can't be beautiful and full of heart and moving. And so, yeah, so all of those things are kind of coalescing in me at the same time, and I found my work starting to take on, starting to push a few more boundaries.
Right.
But now I'm writing a novel, and I find that the ways that I'm experimenting are sort of larger on more macro levels instead of playing with point of view so much or playing with language and sort of playing with structure.
Yeah.
And so that's, for me, a different kind of experimenting but still fruitful and rewarding.
Now, experiment has some risk that goes along with it as well. I suppose as far as gaining an audience, I think that the larger audience is not an experimental reader. Is that anything that concerns you, or do you not worry too much about that when you're working?
Well, I don't worry too much about it when I'm working, for sure. And I would also, I think it's funny, I thought I didn't like experimental writing until I realized that Moby Dick is experimental, and Shakespeare is experimental. And, and so I think that there's this false idea, there's sort of this idea, oh, that's experimental, so I don't understand it, and it's not written for me, and it's elitist. But actually, people, you know, we just don't think of Shakespeare as experimental because he's been canonized, and he's read all the time. And
he's always been there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, nothing being, you know, nothing new going on there.
Right.
So I think that the average reader probably is actually at heart more open to experimentation than he or she might admit on the face of it. But I also think, I mean, there is a line, right, where you don't want to, some writers do, and that's their project. They want to alienate. They want to write, you know, irrecuperable or unrecuperable texts. So like Samuel Beckett might be an example of that.
Right.
And that's a certain kind of project. I'm interested personally in narrative and recuperability. And so I'm interested in taking the reader with me and not alienating necessarily, but also taking risks at the same time. And I think that can be a fine line, and maybe in some of these stories I've crossed it, and maybe I've failed in some ways, but I think it's always worth pushing that line, too.
Right, and I don't mean to suggest that your work is so experimental that it's incomprehensible. I mean, it's absolutely, you've totally succeeded in bringing the reader along with your narratives, but you know, you still have to think about, Who am I trying to reach, you know, and who are the, you know, who are the readers I'm trying to reach?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I would think of like maybe only one or two of the stories would be like, you know, maybe kind of not recuperable for all readers.
Right.
But I do, you know, my husband is an experimental writer, so I do find myself kind of being defensive about it without even people are like, yeah, that's cool, it's okay, don't worry, pat me on the head, you know. Why are you getting so bent out of shape about this? and I do think that there's this like hostile attitude about experimental writing, but what I think is cool about, say, independent publishers and independent presses is like the kind that you and I have published with is that I feel like that line is not as hard and fast as it would be at like Penguin or Viking or FSG, even FSG puts out experimental works, right?
Sure.
So, but I feel like commercially that line is really like, oh, nope, too experimental, can't just sell this as a midlist paperback, that'll never fly. But that doesn't hold true of small presses, which is really exciting actually, which is exciting for there's this kind of new, I think, new era of publishing that's unfolding now, that's less interested in, still interested in marketability to a certain extent, but not interested in gatekeeping as much in terms of style or content or voice, which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I want to just ask what you might have read lately that you would recommend or that you've particularly enjoyed.
Well, just going off of our talk about experimenting, I've actually been spending the summer sort of reading, trying to read the entire backlist of this great press called Dorothy: A Publishing Project. And it's a small press put out by Danielle Dutton, and they publish experimental female writers. And they're just awesome. The books are awesome. This summer I read The Wall Creeper by Nell Zink, which, you know, her second novel just came out, Miss Wade, and she was profiled in The New Yorker, and I don't know how Dorothy got her, you know, like she's a big get, and wow. She just, you know, they publish, they're a very tiny press, but they publish these amazing books. So Nell Zink is one of their authors. Joanna Rocco,
yeah,
is an incredible writer. And her latest book, Dan, came out, which is really funny, which is kind of a departure from some of her recent work, but kind of a return to her older work. Dan is a really funny book. And there's a Renee Gladman's book, Event Factory, which is just, like, talk about irrecuperable. That might be irrecuperable, but it's so fascinating to struggle with that book. It's just, it's really great. Huh. And, oh, and then Amina Kane's Creature, I also read this summer, which is a short story collection, which is, some people have called it quiet, but I think it's really, it really is more reflective and pointing inward in this really interesting way
yeah.
that we call quiet, but I don't necessarily think it's quiet. I think it's just not full of car chases and explosions, maybe. I don't know. But I really, I'm so in love with that press. I feel like they can do no wrong in my eyes. So that's what I would say, is I encourage everybody to go out and check out their website and buy their books. They're great.
All right, great. And then you mentioned earlier that you're working on a novel. So are you able to talk at all about what that project is like, or not yet? Or
yeah, I am. I think I'm hopefully going to finish a draft of it soon, so I better be able at this point to talk about it, but I'll give it a shot. We'll see how it goes. It's a novel right now tentatively titled Return Frequency, and it's dealing thematically with the many ways we lose home.
Oh.
And it's also interrogating the stability of the concept of home.
Uh-huh.
So what's happening is the beginning, there are these three friends, and they're in high school. It's 1993, and they're having this love triangle thing going on. And then there's a big flood, and it's set in the Midwest during the flood season of 1993 in the summer. And then it sort of, the novel flashes forward to 2008, and we see that one of the friends has died. And so this sort of sets in motion the story where the other two friends go off on these journeys to try to rebuild the home that they felt like they left behind when they were 18, or that they lost in the flood in these various ways. And one woman moves back home and becomes a lifeguard again, even though she's in her 30s, right? So, and tries to, like, rekindle the romance with her high school boyfriend because she read a romance novel that told her, you know, that did this. And then the other friend is this drunken realtor, and he sort of is a mystery lover, and he decides that their friend has been murdered, and he decides to try to solve her murder, even though it's not clear that she was actually murdered.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm really interested in this sense, too, in the ways that genres shape and play out in novels, and the ways in which novels can subvert our expectations. So, you know, so the mystery and the romance are sort of frustrated. And those are the macro things I was talking about earlier that I'm kind of playing with now.
Now, who's narrating? Are the two main characters that exist in the 2008, are they narrating? Or?
Well, this is a big problem for me because the voice, the narration, there was a specific voice and style that I was writing in, and I just felt right in. But it wasn't either of the characters the book is about. So this posed a real problem for me, and it took me a long time, but I think I figured out a solution to it. But that's all I will say about that.
Okay. It's the flood. The flood is narrating.
Right. The river itself. Actually, that would not be the first time that someone would have done that, but no.
All right, great. Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show. The name of the book is Anatomies. It's a story collection by Susan McCarty, published by Aforementioned Productions. Susan, thank you so much for being on Write the Book.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Susan McCarty. She is a great writer, but also just a really nice person, really fun to talk to. You can learn more about her work at her website, susanmccarty.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by Susan, my guest, Susan McCarty, whose inspiration for the story Anatomies came from the autobiography Berlin Childhood Around 1900 by Walter Benjamin. And in that autobiography, Benjamin maps his life onto the places and spaces of his youth in Berlin. For example, he writes about the hallway where the family telephone, which he describes as an outcast and my twin brother, was hung. He writes about the Tiergarten, a park in Berlin where he first experienced romantic love. Susan suggests that as a prompt this week, you think about your own places and spaces and map some memories onto them, however small or insignificant seeming the place, space, memory, or emotion. Limit yourself to 600 words for each memory place. The point here is to make an active setting for your story and to notice the way in which setting and plot intertwine to make each other. Susan also shared a link to Dorothy Allison's wonderful essay, Place, in which she talks about how place is not a backdrop for action but an integral part of it. I will put a link on the podcast site to that essay, which appears on the Tin House website. And for further inspiration, Susan also recommends checking out the great website Mapping Salt Lake City, which can be found at mappingslc.org. It's curated by the poet and essayist Paisley Rekdal, and I will put that link on the Write the Book website this week as well. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations, with standards like eyeballs, jerry bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by the farmhouse Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. Before I close, I want to mention something. Former Write the Book guest and wonderful contributing writer to the Burlington arts scene, Susan Weiss, passed away recently, and I just wanted to mention that. Susan was an incredible person. She did a lot for writing in the Burlington area. She directed the writing program at Burlington City Arts for a time. She was one of the original founders of the Burlington Book Festival. She was a prolific writer. She wrote a number of novels, and she was on Write the Book a number of years ago. Anyway, I just wanted to pay tribute to Susan. She was somebody who always inspired me, and I will miss her. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host, Gary Lee Miller, will be back in October. He's on a little bit of a break right now. Gary's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.